From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Bill Derezowitz spent many years getting an Ivy League education. He spent 10 years teaching at Yale. And he is here today to tell you that this country's top schools are not its best schools. They've become a breeding ground for this country's new elites, training grounds for the timid of mind. Boy, has he set off a firestorm. This hour On Point, the problem with this nation's top colleges. You can join us on air or online. Would you give your right arm to get your child into one of the country's top schools? Why? For the education? For the connections? The promised job at the end? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. So joining me first now from Portland, Oregon, is Bill Derezowitz. His essay in The New Republic is called Don't Send Your Kids to the Ivy League. His new book is called Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. Both have provoked a firestorm of criticism, to say the least. You can find links on both at our website, onpointradio.org. Bill, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks for having me on.
So what are the traits of excellent sheep?
Well, they tend to be risk-averse, very focused on getting to the next stage, on getting the next credential, the next gold star, less certain about why they want to do it. And when they get to the point where they have to start to make decisions for themselves, when they get towards the end of college, they often find that they're not sure what they want to do with their lives because what they've been doing up until that point is basically what the system has demanded of them. They've jumped through all the hoops. Now there are no more hoops. What do they do? What I found as a teacher and in the last 6 years of talking to a lot of kids and other people about this is that there's a lot of distress. There's a lot of anxiety. People have a sense, these kids have a sense of sort of almost a sense of emptiness. Like, who am I after all? What is this all for? Mm.
As it relates to higher education, you say the word training is starting to replace the word education. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. I think even and maybe even especially at these top schools that we're talking about, kids are being trained to do one particular thing, to fulfill one particular specialty. They're given a narrow technocratic kind of education, skills, which is great. Obviously, they need that. We need them to have that. What is getting lost is a sense that college and education in general should be about something more than that as well. It should be addressed to the student as a whole person. It should help them to begin to answer for themselves the questions that we all ask as human beings, not as doctors or lawyers or consultants or nurses or teachers, but what does it mean to live a good life? What do I think a good society should look like? These questions, believe it or not, never come up or rarely come up in the educational process anymore. There simply isn't time for it, and it's really nobody's job to help students raise and think through those questions.
So Excellent Sheep is a book. It's a sharp look at this high-pressure conveyor belt life that begins with parents, then moves to counselors who have impossibly high expectation, and it culminates into sort of a, as you call it, a skewed education applications process. I'd like you to talk about the experience you had as a member of Yale's admissions committee. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was like?
Sure. The thing that struck me the most about that process, I want to say also that I think the admissions committees themselves have all the best intentions in the world. I was very impressed with the admissions officers I met. They really want to do the right thing. But the system has become so distorted that the criteria that they're forced to use are just completely out of balance. So the thing that struck me the most was that the admissions counselor, the admissions officer, when presenting a case, would start by listing the students' extracurriculars. And if they only had six or seven, they already had kind of two strikes against them, really, because that wasn't enough. The typical admitted student would have 10 or 12. It was clear that this was that these were the people we were letting in were young people who were just never had a moment to themselves, never had a moment of reflection, were what David Brooks calls achievement machines. That was the thing that struck me most in that admissions process. But I should say, look, I was on the admissions committee for a grand total of 1 day, which was the way it worked at Yale for faculty. The point is, I had been seeing the products of the admissions process for 10 years. And what I saw that day confirmed what I had been seeing in the classroom for 10 years. Really smart kids, really motivated kids. Very few kids who had a sense that their education was about something larger or something more than accumulating credentials to get to the next stage.
So how are top universities then complicit in creating excellent sheep?
Right. So I want to be really clear about this. This is not just the university's fault. And as you said before, this really starts much earlier. In many cases now, I mean, I think we've all read articles about this. There have been documentaries about this. This starts in seventh grade, fourth grade, first grade. The reason that colleges, I think, are especially culpable is that the reason it all happens is to produce kids who eventually, when they are 17, 18, will be able to get into an Ivy League college. It's the admissions process that everybody knows is waiting at the end. You need, like I said, 10 or 12 extracurriculars. You need 7 or 8 AP courses. You need to demonstrate service, leadership, musical instrument, sports equipment, foreign travel, great college essay based on some spectacular experience you had. That's what's creating what I call excellent sheep. What actually one of my students called excellent sheep, referring to herself and her peers.
How does this all relate to the vast majority of this country that will never get an Ivy League education? What's the broader message you're trying to convey here?
Right. That's a great question. First of all, not just the Ivy League. I'm talking about really the several dozen top schools, maybe even up to 100. I would define the schools as what the college guides would call most selective, admissions rates of, say, 33% or less. So there are actually quite a number of schools like this, just varying degrees of intensity. James Fallows, the journalist, has written that, in his estimation, 10 to 15% of high school graduates are caught up in the selective college admissions process to one extent or another. I mean, we know that a couple of thousand kids get into Harvard every year, but about 35,000 apply. If James Fallows' estimate is right, we're talking about 300,000-400,000 kids a year. So this is not such a small slice. This is a lot of kids. But the reason it affects everybody is that these schools are the institutions that have been producing our leadership class, really, I mean, actually for well over a century, but specifically over the last few decades, they have produced what we have come to call the meritocracy. Now, meritocracy sounds like a great thing, and it could be a great thing. The problem is if we look at the leadership class that we've gotten in the last couple of decades, they are comprehensively failing. I mean, I think we all recognize that, not just government, but banks, corporations, universities themselves, and they are failing in exactly the ways that you would predict from the system that's produced them. They look exactly like excellent sheep themselves. They're risk-averse. They're narrowly technocratic. They're very self-serving. They're very self-satisfied, and they're very out of touch with the rest of us.
So this book is based on an essay, I believe, that was called The Disadvantage of an Elite Education, which has been viewed more than a million times online. I mean, it went viral. What has the response to that suggested to you about this issue?
Right. You see, in many ways, this is a book that found me and not the other way around. 6 years ago, I published this essay, Disadvantages of an Elite Education, in a small literary quarterly. I didn't think very many people would see it, and it went viral immediately. And as you say, it's been read not just – it wasn't even a million times all at once. It was thousands of times a month over the last 6 years because kids and recent graduates have been passing it around to each other. And a lot of them have written to me. A lot of them have invited me to talk at their schools. I've given a whole series of talks over the last 6 years. What I discovered, what I did not realize I had done, was to tap into an enormous hunger among these kids, and I think among a lot of kids, for a discussion precisely of these things. What is my education doing to me? Who am I becoming? And what is my education really for? Kids want to talk about these things. You know, I mean, I'm hard on the kids, but I'm really hard on us who've made them this way, because they still have all of the natural longings of youth for meaning, for idealism, for a sense of purpose. And many of them, not all of them, but many, many kids feel that their education is not addressing this at all. There's a young woman at an event I did at Stanford a few months ago who asked a beautiful question. She said, "What is the origin of our dreams?" In other words, she had a sense of having been instilled with all these desires and dreams that weren't hers and that she didn't even know where they were coming from.
Simply put then, Professor, what is a meaningful education to your mind?
Well, I think a meaningful education is, first of all, an education that helps you discover your own sense of meaning and purpose. In other words, find your way to a life, a job, a career that means something to you, that isn't simply an attempt to fulfill desires, namely for success in the conventional sense of the word, for status, for great wealth that society has sort of instilled in you. And then, as I said before, an education that helps you to think through the biggest questions of what it means to be human.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. As America's college students get ready for the new year, we're talking about what the top schools really offer their students. My guest this hour is Bill Derezowitz. He's author of a new book, Excellent Sheep, and his essay in The New Republic is called Don't Send Your Kid to the Ivy League. Both have provoked a fiery backlash, and in a few moments we'll hear from one of his critics. Let's go to the phones first in Nashville, Tennessee. Jennifer's on the line. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to On Point.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I'm about to start my junior year at one of the, like, top schools in the country. I go to Washington and Lee University in Virginia. And I really identify with the point about people becoming sheep. Academically, I feel that I've been very challenged. I'm told to, like, push boundaries and go really far with whatever I choose to study. But as the campus culture goes, I feel like everyone's just kind of becoming the same person. Everyone's going into finance. Everyone is very conservative on my college campus. And I've seen myself change to kind of become more similar to that. And I find it kind of disconcerting. Mm.
Jennifer, thank you. Bill, you write that kids are funneled into predictable majors like economics at these top universities and predictable careers like law, medicine, finance, consulting. And then you write, quote, elite schools like to boast that they teach their kids how to think, but that just means training them in the analytical and rhetorical skills necessary for success in business and the professions. College kids, you say, treated more like less like scholars, more like clients. Is that the bottom line?
Well, that's a big story in higher education for the last several decades, and a big throughout our university system, a big problem that schools, in many ways, have been forced to think of students as customers, which also means that they are giving students what they think the students want instead of what they know the students need. You know, Harry Lewis, the former dean of Harvard College, wrote a book called Excellence Without a Soul, where he made some of the same points I'm making. And he said, among other things, that Harvard no longer knows what a good education is. Think about that. That's what he's talking about. And that's, I think, what Jennifer was talking about.
You say as schools shift from the humanities to, quote unquote, the practical subjects, like economics, for example, so that students are losing the ability to think independently, to think critically. Give us the evidence of that.
Well, the evidence that they're and I should say, schools are shifting. It's the students that are doing it. And again, I mean, I think they're doing it because they're responding to the messages they're getting about what education is supposed to be about. The evidence that this is happening is that at 26 of the top 40 colleges and universities, according to, you know, the U.S. News rankings, 26 of the top 40, economics is the most popular major. I think it was 8 of the top 40 20 years ago. Mm. So, I mean, that's a striking statistic. One major. There are lots of majors in every college, but more than half of these schools, 60%, one major. Students have been told over and over and over again that college is about practical career preparation. And again, of course, that's an essential component of it. But we used to understand there was never a golden age. I'm not nostalgic for some earlier time, but we did used to understand, and colleges used to talk about before they started treating their students like customers, hey, you're here for another reason, too. You're here to grow up. You're here to become an adult, to become a self. And that means a lot more.
I want to bring one of your critics into the conversation now, Bill. Yishai Schwartz is a reporter and researcher at The New Republic. He himself is a Yalie, class of 2013. He wrote a rebuttal to Bill's essay in the same journal, The New Republic. It's called "An Attack on the Ivy League is an Attack on Meritocracy Itself." We also have a link to his essay on our website. Yishai joins us from Washington. Welcome. Nice to have you.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
So you wrote this rebuttal in The New Republic. You've heard Bill lay out his case again today. What's your reaction to his essay and to his theories in this book?
Well, first of all, it's really exciting to be on here. I read the Disadvantages of an Elite Education years ago, and I really appreciated it at the time. But I think I'd say two things, one about the crisis of meaning and the other about the meritocracy. And first, I think it's just unfair to blame the crisis of meaning on the universities or on educational institutions in general. Professor Derezwich is right that today's students are racked by existential uncertainty that their grandparents might not have had. But so are people outside of the universities. A difficulty finding meaning seems to be a feature of modernity in general. It's a central problem of the secular age. So I'm not sure that blaming that on the universities is really fair. But my bigger issue is Professor Derezwich's attack on the meritocratic ideal of the university. Essentially, he's saying that we're selecting for the wrong things, like mindless resume padding instead of real passion. But my experience wasn't at all like that. I think that the students around me were remarkably committed to intellectual achievement, to real scholarship. And that's because these universities were selecting for and promoted things like intellectual passion and service to the community. So if these universities are creating a culture that pushes more people to invest in scholarship and do lots of activities and become broad and well-rounded and broad-minded people who are intellectually passionate, isn't that really a good thing?
Yishai, do you agree it's easier to sort of play it safe in the Ivy League these days than to try to be different? Jennifer spoke to that a little bit.
It's easier to play it safe in certain ways. People definitely, I think, certainly given the economic situation the country's in, are sometimes concerned about getting jobs. And especially, I'd argue, because so many of today's top students in these elite universities are products of financial aid and of immigrant families. Of course, they're committed to economic stability in a way that perhaps previous generations of patrician descendants of, Mayflower type people, perhaps we're less committed and less forced to pursue economically secure paths. But that's only a piece of what's going on. And it seems to me, at least from everything I experienced in university, is that this was an incredible array of passionate people who were committed to seeking real answers to the most profound questions and who jumped into their Plato and into their Aristotle and into their physics with real, real passion for what they were doing and who were running from activity to activity on campus because it was a wealth of opportunities to explore and to get excited about.
But to Bill's point, did you have classmates who were timid, who graduated unable to sort of break out and do their own thing, who were risk averse, who were just trying to get that good job, get the next step, get the brass ring?
So again, I'm trying to think whether there is anybody in my class like that, and I'm sure there are. But I can think of one or two. But if I'm going to talk about the structures of the universities and the kind of behavior that it's incentivizing, the people who we all looked up to in university, and the people I felt the behavior that was really privileged, the people who we were all trying to be on campus were those who were actually genuinely passionate. I remember the girl in my freshman philosophy seminar who loved Plato. That's who we all wanted to be, and who we were all trying. Of course, some people felt the need to get good jobs given their financial situations and where they're coming from. But that wasn't at all what the culture was driving.
Bill, would you like to respond?
Well, Yishai makes a lot of points, and I don't think I can respond to all of them at once. But I will say that while his experience may have been different, and there certainly are exceptions, as I acknowledge repeatedly, his experience is his experience. I'm drawing on the experience of hundreds and hundreds of people who've written to me, whom I've spoken to, not just students, recent graduates, older alumni, professors, prep school teachers, employers. And also, I'm not the first person to write about some of these things. David Brooks wrote The Organization Kid a few years ago. I mentioned Harry Lewis's book, Excellence Without a Soul. Probably the most important is Nicholas Lehman's history of the SAT called The Big Test, which came out 15 years ago. And he directly addresses this issue of meritocracy. And he says, no, actually, what the meritocracy as we've constructed it is selecting for is not intellectual passion. It is, in his words, unfocused ambition and risk aversion. So while Yishai's experiences may be different, he does not describe a situation that I recognize or anyone else that I'm aware of who's published about this in a serious way, who's looked into this, recognizes. I mean, among other, just to take one, he didn't say this just now, but he said in his piece that the people he knew did not do all the things they did in high school out of a calculated desire to get into an Ivy League school. Again, that flies in the face of what many, many, many people have documented about the situation in affluent suburbs, private high schools, affluent public high schools, where it is a relentless years-long race to do precisely that, a calculated desire to get into an Ivy League school.
Yishai, respond.
So I would say two things. I think there is no doubt that there is a push towards excellence at all levels of education, perhaps promoted by these universities, quite likely promoted by these universities. And that's why kids are throwing themselves into their books and into their studies and feel like there's a need to go out and to seek out opportunities to demonstrate what their passions are. But they're not picking their passions out of nowhere, right? The person who picks up the trombone or picks up the French horn or becomes a comedian doesn't do those things in order to get into college. They do them well in order to get into college. They already have their passions. They know what their passions are. And if anything, what this meritocratic ideal is doing is it's pushing these people to really explore them and push themselves. That's a good thing. I think it's a great thing that kids are being pushed to study well for their history exams, are being pushed to try to start organizations around causes that they are already pre-existingly passionate about. So there's no question that there is a push from these universities towards excellence and towards people pushing themselves. The real question, though, is are those passions that are being brought out by this process, are those passions genuine? And again, in my experience, of course they are. And we could all tell the empty, ambitious person who was like running for a campus organizational leadership position because he was an ambitious person. And frankly, that person never won the election, right? Student culture itself is very good at recognizing people who are genuinely passionate.
Let's get a caller in here from New York City. Elisa is on the line. Elisa, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say I'm an Ivy League grad, class of 2006. I saw a lot more introspection in my classmates than Mr. Driscoll describes and a lot more exploration and genuine passion. I have two questions for him. The first is why he only started speaking out so passionately against these problems after he did not get tenure at Yale. And the second is whether he really thinks that the kind of sheep he describes do not exist at state universities.
All right, Elisa, thank you. I have heard that criticism, Bill, that this book is just sour grapes on your part. What do you say to that?
Well, if I protested that it's not sour grapes, I don't know that anybody would believe me because I think people are going to have their own assumptions about why I did this. As I said, this book chose me more than I chose it. I wrote the essay. I had some things that I felt needed to be said. The response came back to me, as you said, a million page views, et cetera, et cetera. My real motives for writing this is because I still care deeply about students and I care deeply about education. Look, if it makes any difference, I didn't ever expect to get tenure at Yale because it's very rare for junior faculty to get tenure at places like that. Also, you know what? It doesn't really matter why I wrote this, right? What matters is whether it's true or not. And there is a great deal of evidence, of testimony, that I'm onto something very important and very real. Let me just say quickly that Yishai uses a lot of words that have become, dare I say, cliches in college and in the college admissions process. Passion, excellence, merit, leadership, service. I don't think those words mean what they used to. I don't think they mean what he thinks they mean. In some cases, they don't mean anything at all. And if I could just use the word, if I could just talk about the word passion, which seems to have become the important one here. Helen Vendler, Harvard professor, poetry critic, she wrote an essay for Harvard, I think the Alumni magazine, that said, look, we're not going to ever produce the next T.S. Eliot because somebody who really who's a genuine poet, who really is passionate about poetry, isn't going to want to do 10 extracurricular activities, isn't going to care about being the leader of a club or also playing a musical instrument. Passion means the exact opposite of doing everything well. It means not caring about anything except the one thing that is more important to you than life itself. I don't see a system here that promotes that in any fashion.
Here's another call from Maria in Cleveland, Ohio. Maria, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
Hi.
I just have two comments. One is that I used to teach at a private all-girl high school, and what I saw in my students, or in many of our students, was that they were really trying to get into these Ivy League schools. And in trying to do so, they did overextend themselves by competing in several sports, several clubs, trying to get into AP classes. And what I started to see was that they were losing a sense of who they were, losing a sense of who they were becoming. And they really were sort of losing that whole high school experience, teenage experience. And I respected their desire to achieve entrance into these schools, but I always kept asking myself, at the cost of what? Are they ever going to look back on these years and think, well, gosh, I kind of missed that whole high school experience of really getting to know my peers, myself, really developing a love for a certain subject. So that's my first comment. My second comment was that I attended Cleveland State University. I was an English major with a minor in secondary education. And my professors were really at the top of their programs. They had published numerous pieces. And I thought that my education was really top-notch, and that was a state school. And I always wondered, you know, how could this be different at an Ivy League school? Because I felt that it was what I was putting into it, not necessarily what the school was giving me. These professors guided my love for literature. They helped me to explore different avenues of the literature. They enlightened me on so many things. And I think, you know, a lot of it has to do with what you put into it, not necessarily what's being given to you. So those are just my two comments.
Maria, thanks so much. I'm glad you called. Yisha, I'll give you the last word here in this segment. Is there anything that Bill captured in this piece, in this book, that does resonate with you, that could be different at our higher education levels, higher education levels?
So there's no question that I think these universities could be doing a better job of going out and seeking out people with particular passions that perhaps, right, are not, right, they're bad at math, but they write beautiful poetry. And I think he's correct. Those people aren't always selected for. But the vast majority of time, I really have to say, they are. He himself notices that pointy people, that when they're very pointy, they get into these schools. I think these schools really do privilege people who are passionate about particular things. It's just people who aren't as pointy that need to be a little bit more risk-averse, and that's frankly the kind of society I want to live in, where the really good poets don't have to study math, but everybody else probably should pursue lots of things more generally.
Yishai Schwartz, thanks so much for your thoughts today. I appreciate you coming on.
Pleasure.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're hearing out a big critique of this country's elite schools this hour by one of their own, and a defense of those schools also. My guest this hour is Bill Derezowitz, author of Excellent Sheep. And he is an essayist and an author. His new book is The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. Let's go back to the phones. Brian is in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Brian. Glad you waited, and I'm glad you called. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
I have two comments I'd like to make. First, I went to two different private colleges for my undergrad and also a public institution. I transferred twice. And I'm starting my master's at Yale, so an Ivy League there.
Okay.
And while I haven't started yet, I do identify with what Bill was saying about the private school, which actually tried to style itself as an Ivy League. I'm someone from a working class background. I was a first generation college student, and I went into fine arts. So those three things, I think I felt often pitted against the rest of the college somewhat. I did feel that there was sort of a general tug toward not stepping outside the lines, you know, staying inside the box, even if that box is fairly large and you know, phrased as a big liberal, liberal in the sense of free thinking ideology. Mm-hmm. The second thing I wanted to say is that I really think that regardless of where you fall on this issue, we really need to be talking about it a lot, because I certainly have, and I think a lot of other people do have, sort of silent opinions about this or silent theories about what education is. And in some cases that's, you know, to get a good career, and in some cases that's to become a very wonderful person who does a lot of things and is thinking about a lot of things in new and creative ways. And I think when we don't talk about that, and when we don't accept and maybe balance those separate reasons why we may go to an institution of higher learning, what really happens is that all of those reasons get sort of subsumed into the idea of prestige and power. And I think that reflects society at large. We often value power regardless of what the meaning behind it may be. And I think we just need to be talking about this a lot more.
Thoughtful comment. Brian, thanks so much for calling. I appreciate it. Let me bring another voice into the conversation today. Joining me now from New York is Alexander Nazarian. He's a senior writer at Newsweek, where he reviewed Derezowitz's essay for the current issue of the magazine. Again, you can find links to all three of our guests' essay at our website, onpointradio.org. Alexander, welcome to you. Nice to have you.
Pleasure to be here.
So you've been listening to this discussion. You reviewed Bill's book. In Newsweek, you read Yishai's rebuttal in The New Republic.
Yes.
Do you buy Bill's argument? Is what he says broadly true?
I think both have good points. I do think Yishai is right. It's very difficult to measure for meaning, right? You have 10, 20,000 applicants to a college. How do you determine which one is there sort of wants to attend an Ivy League school because he or she wants to find meaning, and which one wants to attend because he or she wants to go work for Goldman Sachs. So that to me is really just a difficult, I think that's a challenge. So in lieu of measuring meaning, we measure SAT scores. Now, I do also think that Excellent Sheep makes an excellent point, which is that increasingly, the kids who are going to the Ivies are coming from very selective public schools or else private schools. So the feeder system that existed in the early early 20th century and before, mm-hmm, still seems extant. And that to me is something that we can fix. Right? Selecting for meaning, I don't think we can. Selecting students from a broader spectrum of backgrounds, I think we can, because, you know, I just want to make one point. I was in Ferguson last week, and, you know, I wonder how, and there were many teenagers protesting, and I just wonder how many of those kids reasonably thought they had a shot at the Ivy League, or had even ever been told that they had a shot at the Ivy League. You know, and I think the number is unfortunately very low, and that's something that we should aim to fix.
You're probably surrounded by people, Alexander, who both went to Ivy League schools and by people who did not. Do you feel an education from a top school sometimes sets people back?
Sets people back?
Yeah.
That's an interesting way of putting it. I think it can, but it can also propel people forward. Yes, absolutely. If you go to, and I talk about two other books in my essay, one is about a young man named Robert Peace, who sort of escaped New York and went to Yale only to succumb to marijuana dealing and eventually return to New York and be killed, perhaps by gang members. And another one by a young Dartmouth graduate named Andrew Lowe, who sort of fell into the fraternities and was in fact set back by this culture of, well, we're just going to party for 4 years because we know that Goldman or some hedge fund is waiting for us. So yes, I do think it can. Yes, I do believe that some people will succumb at an Ivy League milieu to sort of the comforts of I'm here, I don't have to worry, or I'm here, I can take advantage of the social life and not really do the kind of intellectual exploration that excellent sheep suggests should take place at an Ivy League college.
Here's Mary in San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Yes.
I'm actually, my doctorate is from Baylor University, and I'm currently serving as a center dean for another Christian university, Concordia University, Texas. And I think I also have a book on the future of the university with the American Council on Education, and I emphasize in there how important values and finding purpose and meaning and a calling in life. I think calling is so very important. When I counsel with my students, I ask them to look, first of all, for their gifts and talents, because that's a certain clue that they're headed in they should head in that direction or consider heading in that direction. And the other thing is to identify where their joy is, wherever their joy is coming from. And so there's no paycheck that's ever going to bring you the joy that finding your calling and using your gifts and talents in this world to make a difference will bring you. So I just wonder what you think about that concept of joy and calling. Thank you.
Mary, thank you. Bill DeResowitz?
Well, I think Mary is getting it exactly right. I think she's talking about the kinds of things that I'm talking about. If I could just quickly go back to Alex and also circle back to what Mary said, I think something has gotten a little lost here. I'm not asking for colleges to select for meaning. Colleges select for merit, right? The question is, what does merit mean? Right now, it effectively means conformity, unfocused ambition, status seeking. I want them to select for curiosity, resilience, independence. If you select for that, you will then produce kids who have a better shot at finding meaning or, in Mary's words, joy, helping, you know, their calling, their vocation, right? I mean, that's what this is about. But Alex also made another very important point. We need to expand this conversation beyond the Ivy League. I mean, part of the problem here is that we seem to be operating under an assumption that those are the only good schools in America. I talk a lot about the liberal arts colleges, some of which were highly selective, lots of very smart students. They do a different kind of job as a whole, educating kids. There are schools where most kids are really curious, really interested in intellectual passion, really not as focused on status seeking. And beyond the liberal arts colleges, we heard from somebody who went to Cleveland State. You know, there are honors colleges and honors programs on public campuses across the country. And there are lots of kids. You know, what she said, person who went to Cleveland State is right. What matters is who you are much more than where you went to school. And who you are is really what we're talking about. Who are the people that the system is producing?
Here's Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you very much. I did go to an elite school a long time ago, but I quit halfway through and I went hiking in the mountains, and then I eventually graduated from a state school. But a few years ago, I went to a community college to learn Spanish and some other stuff. And I signed up for an honors class because I thought it would be more interesting to me to be with other students who were, you know, in an honors class and that we'd have better conversations. But it was the worst class that I ever took because these students just wouldn't speak up and they wouldn't voice their own opinion. It was like they didn't have their own opinion. And the professor would ask a question, and everyone would just look at him like, I wonder what he wants to hear. I wonder what the right answer is. And so I just dropped that class, and I took a regular class and took a lot of regular classes, and they were always better, and the students were just so much more. Some of the students in these regular classes were just, they were engaged, and they just said what they thought, and they were themselves. They were authentic, and I just, that compared with also my experience with teenagers today who are just so worried about getting into these good schools, I feel like they just aren't authentic anymore.
Sarah, thank you. Thank you very much. Here's Eric in Austin, Texas. Hi, Eric. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So I just wanted to say that, you know, I went to a public university. I went to SUNY Albany for a good 4 years, and I, you know, I just felt like I was, you know, this chill of the society that just keeps judging out people that are just spitting back information. And eventually I left. I dropped out, and I found a university in Boulder, Colorado. It's a Naropa University, and it was this this place which encouraged everything that it seems like Bill is talking about, this this idea of how to be human in the world and how to engage with your compassion, engage with your listening skills, engage with the world around you, as opposed to here's a bunch of facts that I'm going to throw at you and you need to regurgitate it back to me. It teaches you how to be yourself and teaches you how to be with the humanity of the world, all at the same time while infusing the academic knowledge that is within the inherent education system.
Eric, thank you. These are great calls. Bill, I want to get down to solutions at this point. How do you fix what you're talking about? Does it start with the admissions process? Is it in the classroom? You know, how do you get to fixing this problem?
Right. This is a very good question. And I want to start by saying that whatever larger solutions we might propose and try to implement, kids and their parents can't wait for us. It could be a very long wait. And a lot of my book, most of my book, is directed at the individual kid. How can I save myself from the system, find a way to a meaningful education, meaningful life? The admissions process would be a great place to start. I talked before about selecting for different traits. You know, put a limit on the number of extracurriculars you can put on your application. Stop admitting athletes and preferentially admitting athletes and legacies, et cetera, et cetera. Ultimately, though, I think the real problem is this: the fact that we've created an artificial scarcity of intellectual resources and a situation which everybody feels like they have to get into one of 10 or 12 schools. My utopian vision, except it's not that utopian because we did it 50, 60 years ago, is to publicly fund once again free or low-cost, high-quality public higher education, which most developed countries do. You know, you just have to go north of the border and you have that system. You just have to look at what California was before the budget cutting started, an unparalleled public university system. That's the real solution, right? Not admit different kids to Harvard and Yale, although that would be a nice start, but not so you don't have to get into Harvard or Yale to get a great education.
Do you agree with that, Alexander Nazarian?
Yes, absolutely. And actually, what you know, to be honest with you, I thought some of excellent sheep ventured into the idealistic and the unrealistic. I also thought it concluded with some tangible, highly sort of realistic recommendations for the college applicant and his or her parents. And one of them is just don't maybe start voting with your application. You know, maybe you're much more likely to get a, you know, according to Bill, and he may, I think he probably has a lot more experience than most of us on this topic. You may get a much better education at Oberlin or Whitman College than you will at Harvard, where you'll be in a big lecture hall with an adjunct or a teaching assistant who just will not be able to give you the sort of that spark that'll set you off into, you know, psychology or poetry or organic chemistry, whatever it is. So I think that's one way to do it. And then also to start thinking, I think also we have our state systems, right? And some of them are excellent, like California and New York, but many are middling. And making sure that a state university really does offer the best education that it can to its students would be another, I think, great way to sort of funnel off the best and the brightest, you know, whether in Oklahoma or in Wyoming, wherever.
Mm-hmm. Bill Derezowitz, cap off this conversation with a word to parents. We've talked a lot about schools, yeah. Higher education. Yeah. What do you say to parents these days who are feeling a great deal of pressure?
Yeah, listen. You know, I'm hard on parents, and I feel like maybe too hard because I think they have the most difficult job of all. And believe me, I know that it's not easy. I think if I said anything, I would start by saying Get in touch with where your kids are really at. There are a lot of statistics about how unhappy, especially affluent, high-achieving kids are. And their parents don't know it. And they often don't figure it out until much later. That's the first thing I would say. Get in touch with where your kids are at and what they really need.
Well, the book is Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. Bill Derezowitz was our guest this hour, essayist and author. We appreciate your time, Bill. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having me on.
And Alexander Nazarian, a senior writer at Newsweek. His review of Derezowitz's essay, The American Horror Ivy League Edition, is in the current issue of the magazine. Alexander, thanks very much to you.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can find us on Twitter and on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.